I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal. And today our guest is Steve Cohen, who has his own law firm, Blue Raven, which focuses on, among other things, representing independent directors. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
So we're going to talk about your career on today's podcast, which has been incredibly varied. You started out working for Mario Cuomo. You had a long stint as the general counsel at McAndrews and Forbes, Ron Perlman's investment vehicle. You worked on a case for Napster, among other experiences. So with that, tell us how you got into the law in the first place.
Good Lord, it was sufficiently long ago that I'm not sure that I have anything but my own version of urban legend. I started off as a student at NYU in the early 80s, really not sure what I wanted to do. And after toying with the idea of becoming a history major and a history graduate student, I realized that law school was the most sensible decision for me, given that I didn't know what I wanted to do. And it was very much supported by my parents. And so I ended up going to law school. And that itself didn't necessarily set me on the road. It was being at NYU and being afforded all of these opportunities, not so much from being at the university, but from being in New York City. And I was introduced at an early age to Mario Cuomo. And that really was my first meaningful professional experience.
And so talk about that experience working for him in New York in the 1980s.
So Mario Cuomo was elected as governor in 81. He took office in 82. It happened to be right when I had returned to New York. I was born here, but when I was a kid, we moved out to the Chicagoland area. And I had come back for NYU and was always involved in politics. In fact, I would argue it's hard to have been in and around Chicago and not to have paid attention to politics in that area. It was the end of the Daley regime, or the first Daley regime, I should say. It looks like every major city has its own version of ancestral dynasties when it comes to politics. Little did I know I would get involved in one of the New York versions of it. So I was watching politics, and I was lucky enough, somebody introduced me. It was through my father and a friend of my father's. I ended up meeting Mario Cuomo. I was in college at the time, and I ended up being offered a job as an intern. It started off as an intern in his office in the spring of 84. And what really made a huge difference was summer of 84 was a turning point in the world of Mario Cuomo's national profile. And there was before the Democratic Convention and after the 84 Democratic Convention. And I happened to show up before the 84 Democratic Convention, which gave me a different view of the world and a different kind of relationship and access to Governor Cuomo. And so as a very young person, I was fortunate enough to get this job. It became a permanent job, even though I was still in college. And it was really one of the great formative experiences of my life. And I got to know the first Governor Cuomo very well. He became one of the three or four great mentors I had in my life.
So did you consider staying on and working for him after you graduated from NYU?
I did. And in fact, you know, it's a curious story. I first spoke to the governor about my future and what I was intending to do when I was applying to law school. And I'll never forget, we were traveling. I traveled with him for a period of time. Every morning, I would get up at 5 o'clock a.m. and go meet him and have this large briefing book you got the night before, and he would pepper you with questions. In an odd way, it really was the greatest preparation somebody could have for law school, because whatever answer you had led to three more questions, all demonstrating that you didn't know what the hell you were talking about. And so that was the law school experience, for me at least. So I told him I was applying to law school, and he said, where was I applying? And I, at that point, wasn't necessarily said I'm going to law school. So I was applying to, I think I said the top 8 schools. And he said in a very Mario Cuomo way, what does that mean? The top 8 schools? Who's top 8? Alphabetically the top 8? And I said, no, in terms of ranking. Who's ranking? Is this your ranking? Your parents' ranking? somebody on the streets ranking? And I told him, no, you know, the top schools that, you know, according to like whatever it was at the time, U.S. News and World Report. And he really took issue with the whole concept. He was, in fact, a graduate of St. John's, and St. John's was not on my top, you know, eight ranking. And I'll never forget, he said to me, in your entire career as a student, which has been the bulk of your life, how many educators, how many teachers or professors have truly inspired you, have caused you to look at the world differently, have changed the way you think, and had a meaningful impact on your worldview and outlook? And when he asked you that question, he wanted an answer. And I said, maybe one, maybe two. I said, my history professor in high school, David Dickman. And he said, well, that's very interesting. It wasn't at an Ivy League school where you met this teacher. I said, no, it was in high school. He said, well, what is the probability, do you think, that you're going to meet another one of these inspiring educators in law school? And I said, I guess if I meet one or two, I'd be lucky. And he says, and it's your position that it's more likely you're going to meet one of these at your so-called top eight schools. And it was, you know, for me, an important lesson about how you think about education. In any event, I end up going to Penn Law. He blesses Penn Law. And between first and second year of law school, I came back to work in the administration again. And that, as law students know, is not such an important year between first and second year. It's between second and third. And at the end of that summer, when I was going back to law school, he was running for reelection. He said to me, do not come back here. And I was a little startled. And he said, you're going to go off and you have great opportunities and you're going to be able to do great things and you're going to learn to be a lawyer. You won't learn that here. You won't meet new people here. We'll always have a place for you. I will always welcome you back, but you don't need us, and you're doing yourself, and therefore you're doing me a disservice if you come back. And that really cemented for me that I was going to go off and learn to become a lawyer. And I will never forget, years later, I ended up coming back and working again in state politics and stayed close to Governor Cuomo, the first Governor Cuomo, throughout the rest of my career and the rest of his life. But it was, I thought, one of the most generous pieces of advice I was ever given.
And so talk about what you did after law school, because you, for the most part, have not spent your career in large law firms.
That's absolutely right. And God bless large law firms. The best are truly terrific and they provide great legal services. But I always felt, and I think this is a product of how I was raised by my parents and probably my grandparents, that I do better when I am not operating on behalf of an institution. And large law firms are institutions. And I wanted to be in a place where they weren't looking to hire, people weren't looking to get the advice of, I'll make it up, Wachtell. God bless Herb Wachtell. I mean the institution Wachtell, the institution Skadden, the institution Milbank, the institution Fried Frank. I had this sense that I wanted people getting me involved. And so I gravitated to places where I had the ability to learn on my own and not part of a broader system, with one exception, the U.S. Attorney's Office. I knew I wanted to go to a U.S. Attorney's Office or a DA's office. I wanted to learn how to try a case. And this old great mentor from Chicago, Maury Liebman, who used to say to me all the time, if you learn how to try a case, if you really know how to try a case, you'll be different than everybody else and they will fear you. And in his point, he was one of the originators of what became Sidley and Austin. And he knew from his early days of practicing law that there weren't a lot of people who really knew how to go into a courtroom and try a case. There were litigators, but a litigator was different. And so I wanted to be a trial lawyer. My parents and my father in particular really encouraged me to do public service and try to be in a place where I could learn how to try a case. And so it was the DA's offices or the U.S. Attorney's offices at the time. This is the mid-80s. The Southern District of New York was looming large. And I thought, geez, if I could get into that place, if I could learn there, that really is worth doing. But you need 3 years of experience to get in. even remembering, thinking about, well, geez, everybody said you go to a law firm for 3 years. And so I said, if I could get clerkships, looking back on it, I have a son who's in law school, and if this were his thinking, I would think he was nuts. But my thinking really was, I got to eat up 3 years. And so I was fortunate enough to be able to apply and get accepted as a clerk for Stan Sporkin, who was a great district court judge, but more importantly, a legendary figure in the world of the SEC, really was the father of modern securities enforcement, built the SEC enforcement unit with Irv Pollack, and really is the founder of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, had this extraordinary career. He was now on the bench, and I ended up clerking for Stan Sporkin for a year, learned far more about securities enforcement than you would imagine in a federal district court. And it was a great time. I was talking to somebody just this weekend who was involved in the Oliver North trial. And Stan Sporkin famously had been the general counsel of the CIA and testified at the North trial. And when I was a law clerk, we walked down the hall so that Stan Sporkin could be a witness in the criminal case against Oliver North. I mean, it really was just dumb luck. I find myself in the middle of this thing.
By the way, was I remember watching Oliver North's testimony before Congress in 1987. It was unbelievably gripping. He was represented, I believe, by Brendan Sullivan, who's, you know, one of the great lawyers of his generation. You know, it was compelling television, if nothing else, for those of us who weren't in D.C.
Yeah, well, both sides of the case, I mean, really was. It was sort of being in the room when you had Brendan Sullivan and Williams and Connolly representing North on one side. You had David Zornow, Michael Bromwich, and John Tecker representing DOJ in front of this great, crusty old judge, Gerhard Gesell. And Stan Sporkin ends up being a witness, was called by North, but was turned effectively into a government witness. It was an extraordinary thing. And it really did center around North and whether North knowingly lied to Congress. And Sporkin testified before Congress as well and was asked on cross, when you testified before Congress, Judge Sporkin, did you tell the truth? And Sporkin paused and said, I've been around this town a long time, and I know one thing for sure. When you're called before Congress, you tell the truth. And it was an extraordinary moment in that trial, loomed large. So I happened to be lucky enough to be there for the trial. And then I had a Second Circuit clerkship with this great, wonderful judge, Frank Altomare, who really grew up as a local New York City and then Long Island trial lawyer, did a lot of plaintiff's work. He used to always joke when he was dealing with Judge Calabresi, he would say, we're no different. I just call it slip and fall. You call it torts. But don't kid yourself. It's the same law. And that was the kind of guy he was, very humble. And I was with him for 18 months, but I had a 6-month stint between the two. And Sporkin said, what are you doing? I think, intending to go back to Freed Frank, where I had been a summer associate. And Sporkin said, why the hell would you do that? 6 months. I said, well, I'll be able to make some money. He said, forget money. You got your whole life to make money. Go, I'll get you into the SEC. Spend 6 months at the SEC. And I was actually a staff attorney at the SEC for 6 months between the clerkship. And so that was really my entree into the law. It was Stan Sporkin, the SEC, Frank Altomare. And then, you know, again, I was just by the skin of my teeth. I got hired by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Became a federal prosecutor, assumed I would be doing ultimately securities fraud work, given my background. But, you know, once again, I ended up, without realizing it, taking this odd detour. And I stumbled into, when I was in the narcotics unit, a series of cases involving gang violence. And I ended up connecting with a group of great prosecutors who've all gone on to extraordinary things. A woman named Liz Glazer, who was turning the organized crime unit into a unit that was predominantly prosecuting violent gangs. And I ended up with Liz and a couple of other great prosecutors, Ben Rosenberg, Rich Sable, Jonathan Schwartz. I mean, these are people who all went on to extraordinary careers. And we did gang cases. We did violent gang cases. We ended up forming our own unit. And at the time, everybody cautioned me. You've got to clean yourself up before you leave. You better do some white collar work. Figure it's going to take a year to cleanse yourself. At the time, I didn't think about it. In hindsight, I now realize that it really isn't such a huge leap as a lawyer. From figuring out how to prosecute 8 guys who are running around the South Bronx murdering people and figuring out how do I do a federal RICO prosecution against them, to figuring out the modern day equivalent, which would be how do I figure out how to do a federal RICO prosecution against the Donald Trump organization. It's the same law. It's the same concepts. In fact, when the Trump case was announced and people said it was RICO and this was so extraordinary, I thought, actually, this is no different than what we were doing against the Latin Kings and the Willis Avenue lynch mob in 1992.
Why did you decide to transition into private practice? And then how did you find that transition?
So I was a supervisor in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And 2 things started happening once I got into year 5, 6, and 7. And the culture in those offices have changed. Back then, the culture really was, you come, you do your 3 to 5 years, you get out, you give somebody else a chance. And the offices were much younger. And for good and for bad, I will admit, we were much less mature than the current version of the federal prosecutors in these large offices. So part of it was the economic pressure starts to catch up with you. And part of it was, with all due respect to my colleagues in the U.S. Attorney's Office, at a certain point, I got a little bored. And that sounds crazy because the cases themselves were interesting, but it's the same game. And you have an institutional and systemic advantage when you're a federal prosecutor that you will never again have in the practice of law, and justifiably so. You choose who to investigate, you choose who to charge with a few limited exceptions. You choose where you're going to bring the case, when you're going to bring the case. You have tremendous power to develop your witnesses. And at some point, I started realizing, not that it was easy, but I didn't feel like I was being challenged in new ways. And I thought, as a professional, you have to keep trying new things. I decided that it was time to leave. And Mary Jo White at the time, who was the U.S. attorney, who was extraordinary and incredibly generous and kind as a boss. I've never really had somebody who was so thoughtful. And I was not one of the sort of the close Mary Jo people. I worked for her. I liked her. I had tremendous respect for her. But the kind of career advice she gave me and encouragement she gave me was extraordinary. And so I realized I didn't want to go to a big firm. And I started looking around, and there were a group of former assistants who had a great white-collar boutique that was operating within a mid-sized full-service firm. And that was a firm that no longer exists. We ultimately became Cooley. We became the New York office of Cooley, but it was Cronish Leib. And it was Alan Levine, Bill Schwartz, and Celia Baronholtz, 3 great lawyers. And I ended up joining them. And they had a fascinating white-collar practice, but they also had a very good civil practice. And I ended up there. First year or so, really focusing on white collar cases, largely securities fraud and accounting fraud cases, which were the steady diet of most white collar lawyers in New York at the time. And fate again overtook me. And I ended up with a very good friend, a guy named Jonathan Schwartz, who was and is one of the all time great general counsels, who was a colleague of mine in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And he ended up being the general counsel of Napster. And I got a call one day from John, who had relocated out to Silicon Valley. And he said, I need you to come in and just help me work through this case. And no background in intellectual property law really to speak of. But he viewed me as somebody who had a particular kind of skill when it came to strategizing and cutting through the nonsense. And in Napster, there was a lot of nonsense. And so we ended up working with Boy Schiller, the Napster case, and again, began to redirect my career.
And so talk a little bit about how it redirected your career. And then at this point, or around this point, you go to work for Andrew Cuomo, who's AG at the time.
Right. So I'm at Cronish. We merge with Cooley. I end up doing a case for XM Radio, attracting other IP cases, largely because I was now involved in standing up in court with my partner, Celia Baronholtz, in what was at the time, I don't know, I would say it was among the most significant, but it certainly was getting the most attention of any copyright case and certainly anything in the digital area. So it just gave me a different profile than I otherwise would have had. And plus, it created this notion in the legal community that I really had a problem-solving approach, even in big litigations. And at the same time, I was getting, for good and bad, a lot of attention for a pro bono wrongful conviction case I was doing, which was similarly raising the question with a lot of my colleagues and a lot of my cohort about why is it, what is the common thread? How am I doing a big wrongful conviction case, Napster and white collar securities? And the answer always was, well, he's good with tough situations and he's good with complicated clients. So after about 8 years at Cooley, was at Cronish and Cooley, we were now merged with Cooley. I was thinking, I love this firm, I love this people, but this is a big organization. And the line I used to use all the time, which I think drove some of my partners crazy, or they at least were amused by it, was, if I can't sit around the table and have lunch with all my partners, they're not really my partners, and why do I want to be part of this? And suddenly I had 500 partners at Cooley. And so I was out there looking, thinking maybe I would go to a small boutique. Andrew Cuomo, meanwhile, who I knew from back in the day when I worked for his father and did a lot of political work with him, it led to Andrew had been elected attorney general, was replacing Eliot Spitzer, who was becoming governor. Spitzer had run a different kind of New York State Attorney General's office, put it on the map in a different way. And so the question really was, how do you replace Eliot Spitzer and this all-star group of senior executives he had? And I got a call one day saying, would you come down and talk to Andrew? And I met with Andrew. This had to be the fall of 2006. And I knew a lot of the people he was trying to talk to who weren't really interested in coming back into state service. Or in a number of cases, there were people in the Manhattan DA's office or the U.S. Attorney's offices in New York City, Brooklyn and Manhattan, and they didn't really want to leave and they didn't know Andrew and it seemed very political. And so I ended up working with a few other people on the transition and we connected with all those people. I remember the then soon to be AG said to me, do you know Mylon Dennerstein? Mylon at the time had been a colleague of mine in the U.S. Attorney's Office, good friend, great lawyer, was the Deputy Commissioner for Legal Affairs at the Fire Department. And the AG said to me, will she take your phone call? Like, what do you mean? Will she take my phone call? He said, we've been trying to get her and she won't answer the phone call. She's a friend of mine. Of course she'll take my phone call. Would she go to breakfast with you? Like, of course she'd go to, I don't even understand what this is. He said, well, would she go to breakfast with you if I came? And I said, yeah, I'm sure she would. And so that's how Mylon Dennerstein ends up getting introduced to Andrew Cuomo and ends up ultimately at the end of the story becomes the counsel to the governor years later after doing 4 years in the AG's office. So the transition ends and the notion is you're going to join the administration. I really hadn't been thinking of it, but I got an offer and Andrew said, come in, you'll be counselor, which was the old Tim Russert title when Tim worked for Mario. You'll be counselor and, you know, you'll hire a chief of staff, but until you do, you'll be the chief of staff and sort of run what we always referred to as both sides of the house, that I would keep my eye on the political side and I would do the governmental side. I would run the office. Everything would run up through me. And the day before we were going to announce this, the attorney general said to me, have you spoken to my father about this? And I said, have I spoken to Mario, Governor Cuomo? He said, yeah, Mario at the time was a partner at Wilkie Farr. I said, no. He said, well, here's the deal. He still thinks you're his guy, not my guy. And so you can't come to work for me unless you talk to him. He's your mentor. He said, so either I've got to call him or you got to go see him, and I'm not calling him. So I ended up going up and seeing Governor Cuomo at Wilkie Farr. We sat in the office. It was, I think, 2.5 hours where he debated with me in classic Mario Cuomo style, the pros and cons of going back into government, especially state government and a New York State AG's office. And at the end, he said to me, I can understand why the office wants you. I'm not sure why you want the office, but if you go, I'll be supportive. And that's how I ended up in the AG's office. I was supposed to stay for 2 years. I ended up staying for all four. And then I ended up going to the governor's office, where I was secretary to the governor for that first year of the administration, most importantly for the first legislative session and the first budget. And never had intended to go back to any of that. But to Mario Cuomo's point from 25 years before that, there'd be a role. And if I went out and really learned to be a lawyer, if I wanted to come back, I'd come back in a completely different position. And so I went from being the lowliest of interns to being the number one advisor in the administration.
And so talk about then your transition back into private practice and why you decided to do that when you did.
So I had stayed, my expectation was I was doing 2 years in state government. I was doing it because I thought it would be interesting. I'd been in private practice for, at that point, about 8 years. I wanted a break. I wanted a sort of refresh on my sense of public service. I thought there'd be a lot of interesting things going on politically in New York, all of which proved to be true. But I'm now coming up on 5 years in state service. And if you start adding up the numbers, 8 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office, 3 years of clerkships in SEC, 5 years in state government, I was at a, what one might characterize as a financial deficit when it came to having three kids who were looking, going to college and had very expensive tastes when it came to college. And so I realized I'm not getting any younger. And this administration, I really thought, didn't need me. There were plenty of other people who could replace me, a great guy named Larry Schwartz, and then Bill Mulroe and Melissa DeRosa were the ones who ultimately filled the seat, all of whom were probably better secretaries to the governor than I was. And I figured I now can do what I always wanted to do, which was practice law a little differently, which really was a throwback to the old school advisor, that I was a litigator by training, but I understood complex problems. I now had a view of various large state projects and how the state operated, which really fed into an understanding of big infrastructure and the real estate industry. And so I figured, this is great. I really can pitch myself differently. And I was looking to start my own firm. And along the way, I spoke to Roger Zuckerman, the founder of Zuckerman Spader. And I really wanted his sense of, how do I do it? How would I start my own firm? And by the end of the conversation, Roger convinced me, you don't want the headache of your own firm. You don't want to invest the capital. I have a New York office. At the time, I think it had three people in it. He said, take the New York office and grow it. And that's what I ended up doing. And I took over the New York office. I immediately recruited, one of the great trial lawyers of my generation, Paul Sheckman. And ultimately, Barbara Jones left the bench and joined us. We ended up with my colleague, Mitra Hormozi, a woman named Leanne Stevenson, both of whom we pulled out of Kirkland. And we have put together this real all-star array of litigators. It was really a litigation boutique with me pitching advisory services, especially to public companies and companies that had big projects in the state of New York. And along the way, I had met Ronald Perlman. And I got called over to McAndrews and Forbes to meet with Perlman on a couple of issues. He wanted advice on what was happening in the world of gaming. At the time, he was the controlling shareholder of Scientific Games, wanted to know what was going to go on with the legalization of gambling in New York State and a few other states. And I said that he really wanted my analysis. I said, my analysis is it will become legal. He said, well, what's the basis of your analysis? I said, the basis of my analysis is it's going to become legal because it's legal everywhere. And if you can leave New York and drive 90 minutes and gamble anywhere, a lot of revenue is driving out of the state with New York residents who are coming back home and not paying those taxes in New York. I said, that's why it's going to become legal. He said, I've been meeting with a lot of people. That's your analysis? It's that simple? I said, yeah, it's that simple. And he turned to me and he said, I like the way you think. And I got periodically called by Perlman asking me my advice on various issues. And it turns out that by that time, I was comfortable with the theory that my value is not explaining how complicated things are to people. My value was trying to understand how to simplify them. And that really appealed to Ronald and the people at McAndrews and Forbes. And he said, you really ought to come and work here. Great, but I got a job somewhere else. He said, well, I don't care. I want you to work here. And Ronald is a very persuasive person. And he ultimately said, well, work both places. And I said, I don't think you can do that. He said, oh, yeah, you can do it. You're going to work both places. And I ended up with 1 foot at Zuckerman for a while and 1 foot at McAndrews. And ultimately, I moved over full time to McAndrews and Forbes first as chief administrative officer because I didn't want to be the general counsel. And as chief administrative officer, it's almost akin. There was no COO, but it was akin to being the COO. And we had, at the time, I think 13 companies. It was very much a holding company model, not unlike the way private equity would operate when they would buy businesses. But Ronald was always a long-term holder and was one of the all-time great buyers and one of the all-time terrible sellers when it came to businesses. And that's how I landed at McAndrews and ultimately took the GC title because it was the course of least resistance. And I lasted there. It was at least 8 years and it was one of the most fascinating experiences. I'm probably one of the few people who's involved in corporate law and has been involved in the making of corporate law that got into it from the opposite angle, which is I didn't grow up as a corporate lawyer. I really got involved at the high end of McAndrews trying to figure out how we were dealing with a lot of problems, many of which we created by our own structure, which is we were the controlling shareholder, which creates impediments for all sorts of things and causes you to have to really think carefully. But it's the reason why if you teach a corporations class, you spend a whole lot of time talking about things related to Ronald Perelman, whether it's the Revlon case or MFW Worldwide or Technicolor. The case book is littered with the experiences of the Ronald Perelman world, and much of it not through happenstance, but through a bunch of very smart business people and lawyers thinking through how to deal with some of these issues.
And so just talk about Ron Perelman. What is he like? What is he like to work for? I mean, obviously one of, the great characters in the world of finance in the last 40 years.
It was an extraordinary experience. I came to like and love the man. He can be, at turns, charming and for some people terrifying, and oftentimes both within a minute. And the terrifying is not to people who know him. Ronald can be emotive. It is not real. It is not lasting. I used to liken the difference between Ronald Perelman and working for Mario Cuomo to Mario was like a weather system. Mario would get concerned about something, bothered. He'd be in a bad mood and it would settle in like a bad weather system. And sometimes it would take a week or two to blow out. Ronald was a tropical storm. Suddenly there'd be lightning, a little thunder, and then it would blow right out. It would last, a minute and a half to 5 minutes. And that's, I think, what a lot of people react to. Ronald was one of the all-time great people at making up of anybody I've ever met. And so I think that sort of reputation he has, with a couple of famous exceptions, but the reputation he had as being sort of difficult and stormy, doesn't really appreciate the whole man. And doesn't appreciate how quickly that would pass. He also, as when it came to business, he had a particular genius. And I would say the only other person I've ever really met with or worked for who had that kind of genius was Stan Sporkin. I worked for a lot of and with really smart people. But Perelman and Sporkin would sometimes look at the world and see things no one else saw. It would oftentimes take the rest of the world hours or days, or in some instance, years to catch up. And Ronald could look at a set of financials. It was a fascinating thing. He'd flip through them. He still flips through them. And the first thing he would say is, I don't need the percentages. Just give me the numbers. Percentages are a distraction. I can do the number in my head. I don't need you to tell me that it's 72%. And then he would tear through the thing. And he wouldn't turn pages, he would tear off the pages. And then he oftentimes would say, the only thing that matters here is page 65 and 69. Those are the two things that matter. And there's something wrong on these pages. And it must be that you're not taking into account foreign exchange because these numbers don't work. And the only thing I can imagine that's missing here is something related to foreign exchange. Go back and look. And then they'd come and say, you're right. That turns out that we had operations in Asia. And they weren't accounting properly for the foreign exchange rate. And he'd say, well, there's a lot of money to be made there. That's where we're losing money because the way you're looking at this. And he was always right on this stuff. He can Look, it came up, it started really in the heyday of the takeover era, where a lot of it is sort of that junk bond world, and that Ronald was part of it. In truth, what Ronald was able to do is look at companies, people would say, well, they'd bust him up. No, he actually would look at a company that was a conglomerate and say, look, there's real value here, and there's a real opportunity. These pieces don't belong together. If we get rid of these three and bring in these two, the value is going to be much greater. But what he was able to do was look at a set of financials and figure that out. That was really his genius, and still is his genius. Plus, he had an incredible knack for recognizing where the world was going. And that was probably never exhibited in a better, no pun intended, in terms of his understanding of what was going to happen in the art world. Just, you know, managed to buy things that he knew were going to appreciate dramatically in value just because they appealed to him in a way that he knew would ultimately appeal to the rest of the world. So he was a fascinating and is a fascinating guy in that regard.
So talk about your transition out of McAndrews and Forbes, you know, and then what you've done the last several years.
So like the U.S. Attorney's Office, I mean, there's probably something wrong with me. And if you have anybody who engages in any kind of analysis or psychological work, I'm happy to meet and talk because I recognize I'm deeply flawed and I'm probably exhibiting it in this conversation. But after 8 years, I tend to get bored. And I was at this great job, exciting times. There were challenges ahead and COVID hit. And I just thought to myself, it feels like the world is coming unglued. And I'm sitting up here on 62nd Street, which was great. I love the people. But I didn't want to not be involved in trying to deal with these issues that had become very much of significance to the public. And I remember speaking to somebody in the governor's office saying, look, I don't want to be sitting on the couch when I maybe can be helpful. And so I got a call saying, as we're shutting down the world, we want to create a committee to start reopening the world. We're going to call it New York Forward. Can you come up to Albany? It was Bill Mulroe, who was one of the other secretaries to the governor, who was now at Blackstone. And we'd like you two to put together a committee and start really thinking through these issues. So little by little, over those really dark months, I started getting dragged more and more into, it wasn't truly state service. It was a kind of public service that only existed in the times of crisis. And as part of that, there was a question of whether or not I'd be interested in taking over as chair the New York State Economic Development Agency, which I was really interested in and remain very interested in. How do we do economic development? And I think we as a country could do a whole lot better at infrastructure and economic development. I used to say there has to be more to economic development than stealing jobs from New Jersey. That isn't economic development, although oftentimes that's what we present as economic development. And it can't be doing a project where most of the economic development, not that it's not important, but it shouldn't just be that we're getting jobs for the labor workforce. That's great, but it's got to be long-term and sustainable. And so I got pulled back in doing all of that. And I was very much part of the effort to do the reopening, to rethink how we are doing post-COVID economic development. And at that point, I needed a platform. And so I set up quietly, without any fanfare, a little law firm. And the little law firm for a long time was me. And the law firm now is me and two other people who from time to time work with me. And so that's how I transitioned quietly into this next phase of my life.
And so as you look back on your career, obviously you went to Penn, you know, I assume with a number of people who have made their careers in big law. How do they respond to your career experience, and how do you compare it to the stereotypical, you know, experience of someone who spends a professional life in large law firms?
Well, I think there are three reactions. There are a number of people at big law who think what I did was nuts, that I could have spent a career with less drama and less friction, from associate to partner to counsel. And those are people I have a lot of respect for, but just have a very different view of the world than I have. There are a lot of people who I know, who I'm close to, who are somewhat amazed that I have been able to weave together a career that has had ample public service, ample private work, that has put me in the midst of some of the great lawyers and business people of our generation, and in the midst of some of the great legal issues of our times. And I think to those people, it is something where I maybe traded a little bit in terms of the money I could have made, but they are appreciative of what I was able to do. And there are a couple of people who think that I am the platypus of the legal world, and that I have defied the odds because the career I've had is a career you shouldn't be able to have. And yet, I think even those people recognize that I have some credibility on these kind of issues. I am very much a product of two worlds in the New York area, the New York political world of Mario Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, where I am known, the network of former AUSAs out of the Southern District of New York, where I always am surprised that I seem to be treated as if I have something to offer, is that Delaware corporate world. And I've always been pleasantly surprised at how warm I am welcome in that community, and that my ideas and my views of where the law is and where it's going oftentimes is a little bit different. And yet it's embraced, and it's treated not as if I'm crazy, but as if I'm thoughtful, and I'm probably a little of both. I think that group of lawyers, for the most part, appreciates that it's a different perspective, but it's not a wrong perspective. Now, look, I'm also helped by the fact that I really did get an incredible opportunity at Penn Law, because a lot of the world of the Delaware corporate bar is a product of the University of Pennsylvania Law School and Wharton. And a lot of those folks were classmates of mine, or were a year behind or a year ahead of me. I'm always amazed when you look at who are the judges and who are the practitioners. And a lot of them were in law school with me. And then I also think I was lucky in a way I never understood with the McAndrews experience, and having a real, not just front row seat, but involvement with a number of cases that have changed the face of Delaware law.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, this has been a great pleasure, and I really appreciate the time.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.